Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on list.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
On that. We're joined now by Dr. Benjamin Springate, LSU Health Chief of Community and Population Medicine. The number of drug overdose deaths in Louisiana rose throughout the country as a result of the pandemic, but they rose more in Louisiana than anywhere else. And with that, we welcome in Dr. Benjamin Springate. Good morning, sir. How are you?
I'm well, Tommy. Thanks for inviting me to be with you today. How are you?
I'm very well, sir. Thank you. And this is very important. Thank you for taking the time with us. Talk about the increase, if you will, to give us a little background on this. Where were we and where are we now?
Well, the increase in opiate overdoses has come across the entire country and has been particularly bad, as you noted, for Louisiana. Over the last several years, the number of overdoses has gone down a little bit each year. That's been positive news. It's been perhaps because of increased access to treatment in treatment facilities and medications that can help people overcome their addictions. This past year, however, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention identified that in Louisiana, our overdoses went up more than 53%. It puts us at around 1,800 overdose deaths in the state of Louisiana. This is a crisis, and it's really worrisome.
Yeah, you know, we had a guest last week that, and I asked this question. I was shocked at the answer about using heroin responsibly. And I remember when Philip Seymour Hoffman died of an overdose, his agent said, well, it shouldn't be said that he died of a heroin overdose. He died of heroin. And I guess the point there is no way to use that drug responsibly, is there?
Well, you know, unfortunately, people feel like there might be a way. But, you know, the challenge is, as you're pointing out correctly, the challenge is that, you know, people believe that they're doing something safely, and the next thing they're gone. And a lot of times these drugs, whether it's heroin alone or heroin plus other things that people believe that they are using, are mixed in with other more potent drugs that are maybe 50 times, 100 times stronger than heroin. And when those things get mixed in, you know, even a tiny, tiny amount can lead to death.
Do you have any theories on why the number would have gone up, I guess, half again as many times in Louisiana, or half again as many drug overdoses?
Well, you know, one thing that we know is across the country, as people were losing jobs associated with the pandemic, as people were becoming socially isolated from their supports because, you know, they were trying not to be infected by the virus. And as they were cut off from treatment for a period of time, clinics were closed, in-person meetings of group supports like Narcotics Anonymous may have been closed. This probably contributed to a lot of people relapsing. And that's true across the country. In our state, and specifically, the reason that we may have had a higher rate of increase in overdose deaths compared to a number of other places may have something to do with the influx of these synthetic opiates into some communities in Louisiana. This has already occurred to some extent before now, has definitely occurred in other parts of the country, but It seems, you know, based on what I've read from, you know, recent public reports from different coroners around the state, it seems that there's an increased number of deaths due to things like fentanyl or other synthetic opiates that are 50 times, 100 times more potent than heroin. And people, as a result, are using these drugs and you know, unfortunately not making it.
I was watching a movie last night, and it was about some drug pusher or something, and one guy goes to the other with an idea on how to expand the market, right, to make more money and move more, as they refer to it, product illegal drugs. I guess that's part of this whole fight, is that the people that are selling this are constantly trying to get more people to use it?
I think that is part of it, and I think that, you know, that's one of the challenges that you know, we face in the community is, as we're trying to, you know, provide support to people who are potentially using, trying to get people into care, trying to help them recover so that their families can be safe and well, so that they can be safe and well. On the other side of the equation, there are people who, you know, profit from, you know, expanding their market, so to speak. And so there's a constant struggle back and forth.
Have there ever been any studies done as to how, and I guess if you're going to make the connection between the drug epidemic, not, I guess you could call it a pandemic, but it's spreading either way, just like a virus is. Have there been studies to see how a drug dealer increases his market or how it spreads? Is it student to student? Is it peer pressure, et cetera? I'm just looking at a way to go back to how this all started and how to fix it.
I'm not aware of studies that document and you know that. I think that certainly you know as people find that you know their peers are using things, people that they know, as you know things become more challenging for someone who has an addiction problem, you know, they're going to be being more likely to use, and being around other people who are using is definitely a challenge. And so one of the things that we try to do to support people who have addiction problems is to help them realize that, you know, it's important to change your social circle. It's important to put yourself in a position where you're not surrounded by other people who are using drugs, and being, you know, surrounded by support groups of people who are in recovery can be very valuable.
It seems like up until, well, let me take a break here. We'll pick it up when we come back. It seems as though maybe up until 3 years ago, I don't think if you were outside of the medical community, you knew what fentanyl was. Now it's a word that just about everybody is familiar with. But how did it get that way? Where did it come from? And who's responsible? Is it getting worse? And just how dangerous is this? Because I've heard it referred to, and I think it's accurate, that you're playing Russian roulette when you take something like this. You have no idea if it's going to kill you or not, because there's no quality control, et cetera, et cetera. 917, we're talking to Dr. Benjamin Springgate, LSU Health Chief of Community and Population Medicine, about drug overdose deaths spiking in 2020 amid the coronavirus pandemic. And Louisiana saw the biggest increase, half again as many overdoses as the previous year. Time for taking a break here, coming back on WWL. Talking about the increase in drug overdoses in the country that are up, but in Louisiana, up more so than anywhere else in the nation, up again by half as many, a 53% more increase number of people that have died during the same time period as the year before. We're talking to Dr. Benjamin Springgate, LSU Health Chief of Community and Population Medicine, about this, what happened, and what can be done to address it. So, Doctor, before we went to the break, I was mentioning fentanyl, and my timeline may be off a little bit here, but it seems as though 3 to 4 years ago, I had no idea what fentanyl was, and now it's in everybody's vocabulary. Everybody knows what it is. How did we get to that?
Well, fentanyl was originally developed in the mid-20th century as a pain reliever and anesthetic for medical purposes. In the 90s, it was introduced for use for chronic pain as a patch, but a very potent treatment for chronic pain. Most recently, the reason that it's come to become you know, something that everyone knows about is because it's been imported from illicit manufacturers who are, you know, part of the drug trade from outside of our country and brought here. And because it is so much more concentrated, so much stronger, it's easier to transport. It's easy to put into, you know, drugs, counterfeit drugs that are being sold, and easy to mix with other drugs and to sell on the street.
Is this primarily from China, this stuff's coming from, the fentanyl?
Yeah, reportedly most of it in the United States comes from China, yes.
So what allowed that to happen? Did the Chinese sense a market? Did Americans go there? And I'm not asking you to be a detective here, doctor, but I'm just wondering about how it happened, because somehow, somewhere, the Chinese decided it would be a good idea for them to send fentanyl to the United States.
That's a great question. And I unfortunately have an answer to that one, but it, you know, somehow people who are part of the, you know, illicit drug trade recognized, you know, that this was going to add to their business model and made, you know, made this push or this effort. You know, the good news is that now, you know, in addition to seeing this terrible thing, you know, coming onto, you know, into our communities and contributing to these overdose deaths, the good news is that there are now also treatments that are available that can support people in ways that previously were not as common or as available, and help people recover and limit the likelihood that they will overdose. And so, you know, that's there are at least some positive developments, too, even as we see this, that we just need to communicate it, get the word out, get people into treatment, and hopefully, you know, expand the opportunity for people to, you know, overcome these addictions.
Are people more susceptible than the other? Can one person take pain pills for a year and not be addicted, and another person take them for a week, and all of a sudden they're hooked?
There are definitely biological and genetic differences, yes, that, you know, can lead one person to be more susceptible to being hooked. And unfortunately, there's not really a way to predict that from person to person. So someone can sprain an ankle, can break a bone, doing something completely normal like playing sports or, you know, stepping off a ladder wrongly or something like that. They may, after just a, you know, small week-long supply of oxycodone pills from their doctor, completely legal, appropriately prescribed, may become hooked on this medication and may be seeking that opportunity to continue that feeling that it creates in them and may look for ways to buy pills or ways to otherwise get that high through, you know, things like heroin.
And it is for those people that are, I don't know if the word would be pre- what's the word I'm thinking of, doctor? Predisposed to being addicted. Do they then progress to needing more and more, more quickly than other people would?
Well, you know, regardless of someone's predisposition to being addicted, as it turns out, you know, people oftentimes just because of the biological nature of how our bodies process and become used to these pain medications, people tend to need more and more to achieve the same level of pain relief. But that also, at the same time as they're taking more and more to achieve the same level of pain relief, is predisposing them to a greater likelihood of being hooked on it and having difficulty stopping the medication. So it can be a real challenge, generally speaking. For an acute injury or a short-term event, you know, the goal of the doctor is to prescribe the lowest effective dose for the shortest possible duration so that doesn't happen. But sometimes people have, you know, longer-term pain, longer-term, more severe illness or injury, and that can lead to some of these challenges.
I read John Barry's The Great Influenza, and one thing that I would advise people to read that book for is just the history of medicine in America and how we were at a flat stage, if you will, for a long time, and then we took a giant leap, I guess, around 1920 or so, and the technology would be increasing exponentially till then. And the reason I ask that, doctor, is Have we somehow as a society gotten to the point, and I understand doctors want to keep patients happy so they keep coming back, and if they work for a big conglomerate or whatever it is, they want to get positive reviews by their patients, so they want to make sure that the patient's feeling good. But have we somehow gotten the perception in this country that there should never be any pain, physical pain in life?
Well, you know, I'm definitely hearing, you know, what you're saying, that I think that there's this struggle, this tension, you know, that exists between, you know, sometimes what a patient is experiencing and sometimes what the healthcare provider is able to offer, and the negotiation of that tension can be difficult. You know, pain is a real concern and a real worry, and it can definitely lead to loss of quality of life. It can lead to disability. It can lead to, you know, physical and emotional suffering. So finding ways to treat pain is a really important priority for the healthcare community, for the medical community, and for doctors, as well as for patients, of course. You know, we just have to come up with, strike a balance between, you know, making sure that our approaches to treating pain take into account, you know, other opportunities besides opiates. Opiates may be one piece of the puzzle, but people can also achieve pain relief using non-steroidal anti-inflammatory medications like naproxen or ibuprofen, by doing exercise under the guidance of a therapist, by participating in cognitive behavioral therapy with a psychologist or a counselor. There are lots of ways to approach this from multiple directions at once to try to treat pain that hopefully can reduce the likelihood of someone developing an addiction problem or exacerbating their current addiction problem.
Do physicians sometimes make a mistake in treating acute pain as though it were chronic pain, where maybe, you know, this is going to dull the symptoms for a couple of days and you can tough it out, as opposed to I'm going to kill a fly with a cannonball and you really don't need this. But do you understand the question I'm asking you?
Yeah, I think that there are sometimes, challenges, you know, in interpreting, you know, exactly how much or what of a certain, you know, type of medication would be appropriate to treat the pain that someone is presenting with. And, you know, distinguishing between that, you know, can be challenging. There are specialists now, pain medicine specialists, who are particularly good, you know, in treating the very complex pain cases. But even in the less complex cases, you know, it can be that, you know, sometimes, you know, a doctor may, simply on the basis of, you know, the history of how their practice has been or where they trained or, you know, the community that they, you know, learned medicine in, may prescribe something differently than, you know, a different doctor who's in the next clinic over for the exact same illness or for the exact same injury. So there are definitely times that someone might prescribe more, you know, than their peers would. And there are also times, you know, leading to, you know, the risk of someone potentially becoming used to getting an opiate. But there's also those times that someone might prescribe less than their peers might, and that may lead the person to be undertreated for a real source of pain. So it's a challenge and something that I think that the medical community, you know, tries to deal with on a case-by-case basis, but it's definitely a challenge.
Where does research stand in terms of coming up with an effective pain medicine that is not addictive? Does the body chemistry lend itself to that?
Yes, there are, you know, a number of different approaches now that are used. There are medications that can be applied, you know, topically that are not addictive. The non-steroidal anti-inflammatory medications are very commonly used. These are, you know, drugs like an ibuprofen or a naproxen, but can also be in stronger doses or different formulations. There are new medications and drugs that are coming onto market that are particularly, you know, being used in operative settings by, you know, surgeons, for example, to help reduce the reliance on opiates. So there are a number of different approaches that now are available, and that's helpful. That's positive because that helps complement, you know, the arsenal for dealing with pain, and hopefully reduces some of the risks associated with the potential for addiction.
And on the other side of it, I would think another problem is we've all had aunts and uncles who are older who said, no, I don't want to take all that dope because I don't want to like, I don't like the way it makes me feel. But yet they're living in chronic pain, and it would be good to have an alternative where there was no mental alteration, there was no high, if you will, or none of that. It just took away the pain. And there are efforts being made to develop something like that?
Yes, and I think that we're seeing that already. I think the challenge is, you know, a lot of times people who have, you know, experienced pain for a prolonged period of time, they've tried a lot of different approaches. And so they get tired of trying to see if there's something new that the doctor can bring to the table that might help them differently than what they have been offered in the past. And but I think that, you know, there definitely are new approaches that are being attempted. Sometimes, you know, people benefit also from interventions. So, you know, a pain medicine specialist or an orthopedist, for example, might be able to do an injection into an affected joint or into a person's, you know, chronically painful back that can have, you know, substantial benefits for them for a period of time. But your point is definitely well taken, you know, that, you know, people don't like these feelings sometimes of, I don't want to feel like I'm having these side effects of feeling doped up by taking an opiate. And so they just say to themselves, I'm just going to stay home and suffer. And that's really unfortunate. There are more and more ways to try to treat this now.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate your time. I really do. Anything to add for?
I just want to encourage people, if you know someone who is struggling right now, if you yourself are struggling, you know, with opiate addiction or opiate use disorder, it's, you know, take the opportunity to reach out to a local healthcare provider and try to get in. There are lots of places open, you know, in the community at this point that can help support people in their recovery.
Thank you, sir. Dr. Benjamin Springgate, LSU Health Chief of Community and Population Medicine. We appreciate your time. We will continue the conversation. On the other side of it, still an Amber Alert. Two kids win their dad's car in Ponchatoula.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, O'Reilly!